podcast was a mess.
Welcome back to the Wildlife Nerd Podcast. We're here today bright and early because we've been out doing some bird monitoring this morning, getting out and enjoying the sunrise, listening to the birds call this time of year. So we decided we would talk about monitoring and why it's necessary, what we get from all that. And I think one of the big things that we hear from a lot of our landowners to kind of start this off is, well, nothing's changed over the years. Why do I need to do any habitat work? Or why are we not seeing birds? Or why do I not see deer like I used to? Or the turkeys are going away. So these are some of the things that kind of leads us into why we need to do some monitoring.
We get asked all the time, well, why does it matter? Or like you said, landowners aren't able to detect that change over time because you're staring at it every day. So what's a big change to us going to your property once a year? Is a small, you never notice it until someone points something out sometimes.
Yeah, it's like having kids in your house as they're growing and you don't realize how fast they're growing, but somebody who hadn't seen them in months comes in and goes, oh my gosh, they've grown 10 feet.
Yep.
So similar things with wildlife populations. And monitoring allows us to track those things over time and see those subtle changes and then be able to make adjustments to prevent them from becoming big changes if it's a negative, or promote it if we're looking at the population going in the right direction. It also allows us to monitor any disease issues.
Yeah.
Diseases, we'll talk about that in a little bit, but there's a lot of monitoring that comes into play when we're looking at diseases and how that affects populations.
Especially now that we have some fun ones making their way around the country, or some popular ones that might not have much of an impact, but you still have to look.
Yeah. Yeah, and the research then allows us to know, does this really cause a population level issue? Is this just a local issue, or is this an individual bird issue or animal or whatever? Because there's a big difference in a disease or a problem that affects a single individual versus a population level issue.
That's right, yep.
Because when we're managing for most of these species, we're managing for that population, not for the individuals themselves. Want to talk a little bit about bird monitoring, what it is?
Sure. Yeah.
A bunch of different types. What we were doing this morning was what we call a point count. Mm-hmm. There's transect counts. We do some, what do you call it? I guess remote listening and monitoring now with some of these automated units.
Yep. Autonomous recording units. We will probably refer them to ARUs, but they're cool little boxes we put out on the landscape to record the birds, depending on what our target is, depends on when we put them out and how long for and whatnot, but it's pretty fascinating. The technology is really amazing. Yeah. But with that said, it still takes humans to proof it, to make sure that, you know, they haven't counted a truck that zoomed by as, you know, a stork or something weird.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen some weird things on there, and then we go back and listen, or we get really excited about a bird that, you know, was kind of rare. And you listen to it and you're like, dang it, it's just a mockingbird or something, you know?
So yeah, I've had them pop up birds that are like from Africa or something, you know, down in South Georgia. And I'm like, okay, well,
yeah,
I don't think that's right. And you go listen, it's just a bug or just picked up a bird the wrong way.
Yeah. So there's still limitations, but there's lots of methods out there. And it just really depends on what your goals are and what you're going to use the information for and the rigor at which you need to set up your monitoring. But some of it's just as simple as downloading an app on your phone now.
Yeah.
You know, getting out there and
this is
lots of options.
Monitoring is a great way for the public to be engaged in the sciences. We use a lot of what they call citizen science to help us with monitoring species, frogs, insects,
bees,
birds, anything and everything. There's a lot of different ways that you can get engaged yourself. And it's beneficial to the scientists because we can't cover everything.
That's right.
And so that gives you a larger geographic area, a larger time frame. Like this morning when we were doing bird monitoring, we're doing what we call covey counts, fall covey counts. And we're actually listening for bobwhite quail when they're in their coveys to call. And it's right before sunrise. They'll call for a short period of time. We count the number of coveys that are calling, put them on maps. And then there's this really nice complicated formula that we can stick them into that spits out an estimate of a population. It's not a doesn't tell us what the population is. Right. It's just kind of a, oh, just a rough abundance or closer to a population estimate than you'll get from just what we call spring whistling counts. So it's really good for us to be able to see kind of what our populations are going into the fall. Helps a lot of properties manage their harvest. Mm-hmm. If you know how many birds you have going in and you know that you can harvest, you know, 15% of that population and not impact your population, then if you're tracking your harvest, which is another type of monitoring that we do, yep. Harvest data, then you can utilize that population for recreation and still have a healthy population the next year.
Yeah, and that's critical, especially where we work in the space that we work, that you're keeping track of those things. I can't tell you how many times we hear, we used to do this and now we can't because we don't have the bird numbers. It was like, well, if you're not listening and keeping track of what's out there and being adaptive, that's another thing we're going to probably say a lot is adaptive management,
right,
and reacting to weather cycles and all these other things. If you're not in tune with your birds and your bird numbers, it can be really hard. And it doesn't take much to tip it past something that's not sustainable.
Right, right. And have a population just drop off. Because there's things like, I was talking with someone recently where there's a management that we can do. There's things we can control on the landscape. We can control how often we burn, mm-hmm. or, you know, how often we do disturbance, how many trees are on the landscape, and improving the habitat. But the one thing we can't control is weather.
That's right.
And weather is a big player in a lot of our habitat and the populations of any of the species that are out there. So some years, like this year, especially later in the summer, we had a big drought, and that impacted our population some. We did have good populations because of the early spring, but if we'd had a long-term drought, our populations may be plummeting in some areas, and so you don't want to harvest as many birds. So watching that from year to year is definitely important. Maybe this year we had a boom year because we had lots of rainfall, mm-hmm. so we can provide more opportunity. But that is critical to watch. So not only on an annual basis, because it's not quite as detailed as some people think it is,
yeah.
but the year-to-year and property-to-property information that it gives us is also critical.
Yeah, and to kind of maybe be a little controversial, hopefully not, but knowing those weather patterns and how populations respond, as a hunter, I try to stay tuned into that
right.
as often as I don't go. But you know, we're talking about it. You know, you see people piling up on their tailgates in places that probably can't handle that kind of pressure. But our community is usually pretty good about it. And I feel like if we did a better job teaching people how to be in tune with those numbers and some right. of the subtleties of weather, knowing that state agencies cannot always be reactive. On it every year because of the regulation cycles. You know, it's out of control.
Right. And a lot of times we don't know what that population is going to do until right before right. hunting season.
That's right.
And so for an agency to be able to make that change within, you know, a couple of weeks, it's not going to happen.
No.
It's usually on a couple of years that they're making that out. So that makes it really hard for a biologist within an agency to manage a population because you're having to look so far ahead. Mm-hmm. And you have no idea what the weather's going to do, or maybe staff changes, or you know, your budget's gone, you have a shutdown or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So you're not able to do anything. And when you're looking at planning 2 years ahead on a population, agencies can't be proactive for some reason.
Right. But you know, if we're able to monitor or kind of keep track of some of those things or use our best knowledge based on weather and, you know, Quail Forever right now has this weather podcast, it's been on a podcast, it's a blog, the forecast, and all those things. And that's all based on, you know, I think Ducks Unlimited does one, Turkeys does one, and it's all based on our best knowledge of all the monitoring we've done on the years, how we've seen the birds react to weather patterns, and the best research we have available.
Mm-hmm. A little swag we do there, a little scientific wild
right.
ass guess.
That's right. But, you know, that is what we all can use when we go out. And that's why consistent monitoring is so important. And we work with a lot of people that want to just do it for a couple of years and then be done with it. But population reactions, especially some of the longer lived species, takes years of data right. on a property. And I can't compare my data here to, you know, data that's collected in, let's say, Ohio. You know, it's just different landscape, different right. weather patterns. So it really needs to be repeated. And that's when landowners and some of the citizen science really comes in to play, to partner, to get some of that data.
Yeah.
It's super important.
Well, even within a state, especially a state the size of Georgia or Texas or whatever, North Georgia to South Georgia, our weather patterns are crazy. Our habitats are different. Mm-hmm. Land uses are different. So it's really important on property level monitoring. I mean, you can extrapolate to some other areas, and we have to, because we can't monitor every acre. But it is important to keep track, if you're trying to manage a property, what you have. And like you said, continued, because land uses change. What if you have a tornado or a hurricane come mm-hmm. through, and that completely changes your landscape? I mean, look what happened in East Georgia last year.
Yep.
There, it doesn't look anything like it did.
Right.
You know, the year before. So the populations will change in reaction to that.
Yeah. And some of the monitoring tools that we have now, and, you know, people going out there, but with the recording units, we're able to see guild shifts over time. So the types of birds that inhabit the landscape, depending on the habitat. So if it was a dense oak dominated forest, and we then take a lot of those oaks out, we thin it down and to create like a pine savanna, reclaim that pine savanna that was there, you're going to see a shift in the types of birds that utilize that space right. over time.
Right. Your birds, your mammals, your insects, yeah. the plant community changes. So we monitor a little bit of all of that to mm-hmm. see what reaction you get. And it depends on what the goals. If you're a landowner, you know, and I want X species, then because we've looked at this kind of stuff over time, we know what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
We know kind of what to expect. But then your property may be a little bit different, and you know, maybe you need to do something just slightly different on timing.
Right.
And that's where
fire timing yes. can really make a huge difference.
Big difference. So that's part of the monitoring, is just kind of let us learn how habitat manipulation benefits or changes different species. Like you mentioned already, you know, the timing of the fire. If we burn, you know, in the spring, what species does that benefit? Do we see more of this songbird or this insect, or, you know, do rabbits like the habitat that comes back following burning this time of year? And if mm-hmm. not, then if we shift it to here, okay, so what do we get in that place? So we're using a lot of that. We've got some research going on in some areas right now that are looking at some of the management practices that are going on and the timing, and relating that to the populations, and even tracking where the animals are using the habitat at those different times of the year. So I mentioned there's point counts. We do spring counts, breeding bird counts, whichever you want to call them, where you listen to all the different, usually male birds that are singing to attract mm-hmm. mates. That kind of gives you an idea of more presence than absence at that time of year. So are those birds here? Or are they not here? That'll let you know if they're not there, then you can look at the habitat and see why they're not there. Or maybe you've been seeing them on this property for, you know, 10 years, and all of a sudden now that population is dropping off. What's going on? Is it something that's going on with that population as a whole, or is it just something on the property? So we've seen those trends with nationally, where birds begin to decline because habitat losses or weather changes or whatever it may be. So a lot of that information is very important we're tracking, and not just birds. We track a lot of the mammals, so deer, you'll see elk. Some of the small game don't get tracked as much. Some states are better at it than others, but you know, they can look at rabbits and squirrels and what their populations are.
And then there's, you know, predator management and
right.
looking at those numbers also.
Right.
Those can tell you a lot about what's going on yeah. on the landscape.
And then not even just the animals, some of the things that they monitor are the mast crops.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll go out, you know, early in the fall, late summer, and look at, you know, what acorns. Does it look like the trees are going to have a big acorn crop this year? And that will affect a lot of the different species, your deer, your bears, all of these species that utilize the acorns. And are they going to be having a lot of food going into the winter months? Are they going to be showing up in this area a lot? Squirrel migration is a weird one when mast crops fail.
Yeah.
And they'll see, especially in the North Georgia mountains, when they don't have a good mast crop that year, squirrels will just travel long distances to be able to find food. And they've seen squirrels swimming across lakes and
squirrels.
But so there's a lot of things they monitor plant wise, even
mm-hmm.
cone crops.
Yep.
Looking at how many cones are in pine trees to see if they're going to have good reproduction that year. So it's all very important. We mentioned harvest data.
Mm-hmm.
Been getting ready for that as we're hunting season has started for quail. It's been going on for deer for a while. Your small game's open. And keeping track of what you're harvesting helps.
And what you're encountering, too.
Right.
Yeah, what you see,
right.
Not necessarily what you take. Yep.
And even the time that you spend. I know on our quail stuff, we look at effort because that tells us, okay, is it taking you 6 hours to find a covey? Or are you finding a covey every 2 hours? And that kind of lets us know that kind of what your populations are based on how often you're finding a covey. Am I not finding coveys at all that day? Some of it's weather related. Some of it may be population level, but or maybe you're
dog related.
We won't go into hunter abilities, but there's that data. The harvest is very important for people to report, not just for the agencies, but monitoring that on your own property as well.
Yeah. And like what we're finding too is when we share this information with landowners, there's also research on this, but I mean, we've seen it firsthand. The landowners that are like, yeah, whatever, you know, don't really buy it. But then once you show them, hey, just trust me on this. I want you to look out for this and this and this. Give them a list of things that may or may not show up.
Right.
But when that bird shows up or they start hearing a bird that they haven't heard in a long time, especially we see this with bobwhite, that phone call you get, you know, say, hey, I finally heard a bird,
right.
You know, or we turn back the information about the suite of species we heard on the ARU results, you know, that's buy-in.
Right.
And it makes people more engaged with their land. Or if you teach them different plant species that are important to wildlife or that special flower or when things are blooming, you know, people really get interested. And I think it gets back to knowing the land, connecting to the land, and getting us back to where we need to be.
Right. Yeah, it slows you down when you're doing monitoring or you're having to pay attention to, you know, something that's out there. You take that time and you begin to see other things that are there. And I've seen that with a lot of our landowners, like, okay, listen, tell me what you're hearing for Bob. And so while they're listening for that, they're starting to hear other species or see other species. And then that kind of gets them to notice, you know, the habitat that's with it. And so they start seeing the whole landscape and everything that's going on and paying a little more attention. Mm-hmm. So they start seeing those subtle changes. So all of a sudden I'm not hearing these birds now. Why is it? Yep. And sometimes it's just, well, this time of year, they just don't call.
Yeah.
So it's okay. Because I have some of my landowners who call, well, I'm not hearing my birds now. You know, what's going on? Where's my birds going? They're not calling this time of year. Either it's too hot or they're shifting to where they're not breeding now, so they're not calling. But it's great that they're paying attention to that because that's when you catch those things before problems become problems.
That's right.
But on the harvest side of things, that whether it's a deer and you're kind of watching those bucks grow, so you kind of have an idea. If you're looking at quality deer management, you know, you know what bucks are out there. You know what bucks are now old enough if you're wanting to harvest them, or this buck's been this size for the past 4 years. This buck has been, you know, a spike.
Right.
He's obviously never going to change. So maybe we want to harvest him as a cull buck. Mm-hmm. Or this buck's now really old, and so he's starting to decline. We need to take that buck out of there.
But if you start seeing patterns in poor quality,
right,
when you should have higher quality, then you need to start looking at the groceries on the ground and probably think about thinning and all the things we've talked about before with habitat management to increase quality of forage availability.
Right.
You know, so a lot of that can play in, and you might not be hearing that animal or seeing it because you've let your place go and haven't even really realized.
Yeah.
Or an area you used to have open that they used to use all the time. You've not been disking it or keeping it open. The tractor, I mean, I get it. Tractor goes down.
Right. It doesn't take long, especially in the southern climate, for things to grow up in a fast.
Yeah.
And that's something like if you are hunting or just observing your animals and all of a sudden I'm not seeing them in this area anymore. Well, why? What's changed? Or the animals that I am seeing are starting to look really thin or poor, or there's not as many of them. So, like you said, is this a food issue? Is the population now too high? And so there's not enough to support them. Is there a disease issue now? So there's a lot of things that can happen. And if you're paying closer attention and seeing that change through some sort of monitoring, you can address that. And you think with a biologist, have somebody else come or someone else just come in and say, okay, like a lot of our landowners, I've not done anything different. Why is I'm not seeing this? And it's because it's maybe gradual and you just aren't seeing it anymore.
Right.
But or maybe the landscape around you's changed. Has a solar field moved in down the road? I mean,
that's so important because especially around where I am, we're surrounded by crops. So very large fields, cropland. So I know that if the few of us that are maintaining habitat for wildlife let it go, it completely knocks all of us off.
Yep.
And I could tell by wildlife movement we were seeing or not seeing on our place what was happening. So one neighbor had completely opened stuff up, looked really nice, lots of disturbance. I'm like, where are our turkeys?
Yeah.
They are not over here. Well, turns out he had done something next door. Conversely, we're getting a ton more deer on our place. And I'm like, why are they settling in here? What's going on? Well, it was because of activities next door, them completely wiping a bunch of woods out, nice savannas. It's really unfortunate. But that now forced a concentration on us.
Right.
So, and it's just, you got to just watch.
Right. Yeah. It'll change as land uses change. And then, you know, as it reverts back, it's not going to stay the same forever unless you're doing some sort of management to keep it that way. So those populations, the number of species, type of species are going to change as that evolves back or reverts. So it's interesting to watch. I was talking to someone yesterday that has some hunting land where over the last few years they began to see fewer and fewer deer. But in that time frame, they had a solar farm that's over 1,200 acres installed just a few miles up the road. So they're thinking, well, is this what's impacting us? Has this pushed the deer somewhere else? I mean, because it's just almost touching them.
Yeah, and the studies are just starting to come out on some of that, and it's kind of alarming.
It's like wind fields. You know, a lot of species avoid the wind turbines.
Yep.
They're creepy. I'd avoid them, too. So I'm not surprised that a lot of these species, some of the antelope and stuff, do not like those turbines. But keeping track, as we talked, I think, at the beginning was, you know, diseases, some of the new diseases that are on coming out. And it's very important to be engaged with some of that monitoring, especially as new diseases come on the landscape, tracking where those diseases are, being able to hopefully control the spread of them a little better. I hear a lot of hunters with CWD coming in. Well, the deer don't look sick. All my deer look healthy.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't mean
they
don't have it.
That's the trouble with CWD and some of these diseases.
The deer don't look sick until the last stages of the disease.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no cure to it. It's going to be 100% fatal. And really, you don't want to see a disease in that late stage because it's pretty terrible. That doesn't mean that deer's not positive if he's healthy and spreading it to other deer.
Right.
So it's important to monitor even those healthy deer and see where that
is. Well, and participate. Right. So if you're a state agency or a nonprofit or a conservation organization or someone is collecting or asking for some sample submissions, please participate.
Right.
You know, because that's how we keep track of things. And I think some people are afraid to participate because they think that, oh man, they're going to find it and then we're going to have increased regulation and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you know, that is not really how it works. It's to monitor, keep track of it, and again, be adaptive to what is happening across the landscape. If CWD has been pinged, say in Georgia, it's been here.
Right.
It's here.
Right.
You know, and the sampling methods just can be random.
Right.
But so maybe hunters and people need to trust the knowledge that we've gained from things out west in other states and appreciate the science. I said it. Yes. Participate in the science and stop doing some of the things that we've been
making it a
warning.
Conspiracy theory.
Yes, we are not. That's the thing. Like, people don't get sometimes. I'm going to get on a soapbox here.
Go ahead.
We're hunters. We participate in the activities that we are, you know, we're trying, we're conservationists at the same time, but we don't want to lose access to the resource. We don't want any more regulation on the resource because not only does that make our recreation harder, it makes our jobs harder. Like our daily mental load increases. And so the message is that trust it. You know, we've got, I mean, PhDs in this. We've both been in disease labs. You know, all of our colleagues that are working on this, it's a life, it's a passion.
Right.
And to protect our ability to have access to and to keep enjoying this. So it's not like some conspiracy. And that's why we ask for participation in these projects. And I'm about to launch into a project requesting samples. And the beauty of it is that not only is it for that targeted project, but we can then utilize those samples for other things. Like right. we were talking about genetics.
Right.
Lots of cool stuff that could inform our ability to grow populations or harvest populations, you know.
And or learn why populations are declining or
That's
increasing.
Right. Mm-hmm. And maybe you don't need to put that corn on the ground anymore
right.
to keep things from spreading. I mean, right. that's just the baseline of it.
Right. Like, so what if it's not the way we've always done it? Well, mm-hmm. maybe we weren't doing it right.
Maybe we were part of the problem.
Right. And often were.
Yes.
So let's learn from these issues and mistakes. Things mm-hmm. change, whether we've created it or if it's something that's natural. But like you said, we're out trying to protect it for the future, for our future generation, when we retire or have more time or whatever it may be. And I want to have the opportunity to go hunting. And I tell a lot of them, you know, selfishly, I'm on managing for quail, trying to get populations up so that I can go hunt them.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, I'm not managing them just to listen to them. I enjoy running the bird dogs and mm-hmm. whether it's deer or turkeys, I want to see more turkeys. I enjoy turkey hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And want to figure out why it is.
And eating turkey and seeing where your food is right. coming from. Like, that's the point of pride in our house. Like, the boys love it when they know that their whatever they harvested is dinner that
right.
night.
Jeff and I were talking the other day with CWD coming in. I don't want to eat a CWD positive deer.
Right. Well, you and I
coming from a disease lab and knowing yes. prions. I mean, yeah. I don't want to cause a panic on people.
No.
But just from my mental well-being, I would like to know if the deer that's in sitting in my freezer is positive or not.
Right.
And I would like to stop that spread and contain it so that it's not spreading or it's not at a high prevalence, because it's here.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the state. It's going to continue to spread through the state. There's nothing we can do about that, but we can slow it and we keep it at a low prevalence if we manage the populations.
Right.
And we get the information that we need. And the people that are like, oh, well, I'm not going to participate in this. You don't want the government to know what's there.
Mm-hmm.
You're dooming yourself. You're seriously dooming yourself and all your neighbors and friends and family by not participating in this.
That's a human nature thing. We probably don't need to go down that road. But
I want to know, and one of the things, I mean, like I said, we can't stop CWD. You're not going right. to cure it. But the studies now are showing that if you keep it at a low prevalence rate, then the populations will continue to
some of it is
survive.
Working itself out.
Right.
Right.
Or, just maybe 1% of the population. So you can still harvest a deer in an area that's not positive. I mean, that venison is a huge part of our diet.
Oh, yeah. Ours right. too.
So, we harvest several deer.
We have some chili in the refrigerator right now.
Yeah, yep. I do too. And we just harvested some does because that's the majority of what we eat through the year. It's a mm-hmm. financial and a just a taste preference for some of it. But if CWD is at a 70% prevalence rate in the population where I hunt, that's not going to be there.
Right.
And all of you big deer hunters who want the big racks, which you can't eat, I always tell Addison.
Right.
You're not going to have those, because when CWD gets to that prevalence in those populations, usually it's 18 months and those deer are dead.
Yeah.
After they get it. Well, you're not going to have a 4-year-old buck who's a nice, big, mature, quality deer,
mm-hmm.
because they're not going to live long enough to get to that level.
Right. And you see some of this stuff cycle, again, with weather, food availability. EHD is another
right.
good
that's
example.
That's been big this year.
Yep. And that cycles through. And right. But knowing how it rolls gives us some expectation where it's going to be, how bad it's going to be.
Yes. But EHD is one of those things where it comes in, it hits a population really hard for the year, and then it's gone for 8-10 years probably mm-hmm. on a normal cycle, and the population is able to recover. CWD is a little bit different. It doesn't go away, but what they're seeing is if you can keep it at a low prevalence rate, and the way you do that is by keeping your populations at a lower level, as a more of a natural level where they should be, and not these highly inflated because we have nobody harvesting does, or the landscape is just really great for deer and their populations explode because they just lots of food for them. So you need to harvest those deer, harvest a lot more deer if you're in an area that's prevalent or that CWD is now present. so that you can keep it from spreading as much and you can keep it at a low prevalence rate. So
yeah, there's no reasons. As far as I know, I don't think there's any herd immunity or anything with CWD like there is with some other EHD, which is epizootic hemorrhagic disease.
Yeah.
Since we're using our alphabet soup. Sorry, I forget sometimes.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Blue tongue is another thing, word that a lot of people use for EHD. So, mm-hmm. you know, it's spread by biting midges. And a lot of times during dry years, you'll see that pop up. But it's kind of on a 10-year cycle, and you'll see areas. That's a lot of people see deer dead along, you know, ponds and rivers and stuff because they go to water when they're infected. Not a nice disease. I think in a lot of areas across the U.S. this year, it really hammered deer populations. There's a lot of different things that deer or turkeys may get blackhead or pox, whatever outbreaks, you know, and it affects a local population, drops it for a few years, and then moves on. But these things that are long-term that are here, we really need to address them differently. And
So good resource. Since we're talking about disease, I don't want people to be panicked, but where we get our information is out of University of Georgia Veterinary School. There's also lots of other collaborators, but Southeastern Cooperative Wildlife Disease Study, we call it SCWDS, is a great resource. If you just Google it, SCWDS, there's briefs. They talk about what's up and popping up. You can get it in your email. There's a wildlife disease manual that I may or may not have contributed to over the years, but so I'm not plugging it because it's where I did stuff, but great resources there. Talks about like management.
Right.
And it's not a bunch of nerd talk. It's
You're talking about them, I'll plug a podcast that some of that crew was on recently, Meat Eater Podcast.
Mm-hmm.
They were on talking about CWD and some research that was going on in Arkansas and did a great job of explaining what CWD is and the management of it and why some of the agencies, you know, address CWD the way they do. So, if you have CWD in your area, which you probably do, and there's very few states now that don't have it, it's probably there. They just haven't found it yet. If it's not in your area, go listen to that or look up their websites and find that
information. Episode 766.
There you go. So I thought they did a really good job with that one. And I've plugged it to a couple other folks when we were talking about CWD at a talk recently in the area where CWD has been found in Georgia. So there's lots of great resources. Educate yourself. I know there's a lot of people on there that are trying to make CWD a conspiracy and saying that it's all for money.
It's not real. Yeah, we're making lots of money off of this.
The states are not making
money. It costs a lot of money.
A lot of money. Agencies do not want to see CWD come in because it costs so much, which is why they're doing some of the management or not doing management that some people think they do because it costs so much to do it. And then all the other species, they pay for it because they're not being able to put money towards turkeys or quail or whatever, ducks and
staff is diverted to roadkill deer and cutting heads off a roadkill deer. Right. Like that sounds crude, but I've seen it over and over again in state agencies where they're not doing what they're supposed, not doing what they're meant to be doing in their position because they're dealing with CWD or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the guys that I know, that's what they're doing right now is they'll call each other, hey, there's a deer on the side of the road. I saw a deer. This is in your area. You want it?
Yeah. So side comment. We've been going on this for a while, but it's hilarious. At soccer practice with my kids or at a tournament, and someone that you and I both work with is a wildlife biologist. One of the dads comes up. He goes, we were talking about wildlife, and you could see like something clicking. He was like, well, wait a minute. What do you two do for work? Because we were talking about work and collecting samples and stuff and, you know, told him the fun stuff, of course. And then another dad comes over and he goes, wait a minute. Did I see you on the side of the road cutting a head off a deer last week?
A nice like, bloated deer.
Yeah. He's like, that was me. And it was just so funny. But it's hilarious. But it speaks to like,
yes,
he probably needed to be doing other things for the good of wildlife in the state, but
could have been burning or something. Well, not as dry as it is right now, but normally that's something they would have been doing.
But that was just hilarious. Yeah. The things that we do.
Well, it's also the things that people say, because I've heard a lot of people talk about, oh, I saw this deer on the side of the road. It didn't have a head on it anymore. Yep. They're just hitting it, you know, taking the heads.
No, I love reading what we love when we call the wildlife hot sheets.
Yeah.
I love reading that because the conspiracy theories about it, like, hilarious.
Sometimes it is somebody that's hit a deer and they just took the antlers, but
absolutely
not always now.
Could be a cult, you know, who knows?
Yeah. So we do crazy stuff like that all in the name of monitoring so that we can get the information that we need to make the management practices or do the, what's the word I'm looking for? Get better habitat so that we know what information that we need to create better habitat. But there's some other one other point that comes in, and that's kind of playing back into the conspiracy theory thing about all the funding. They're getting paid for all this. Hmm. There are sometimes grants that we get for some things where we are required to monitor in order to get money as a condition of the funding.
It is. More and more.
The CWD is not one of them, but it's normally something somebody's written from a research side of things or habitat. We can do this habitat work or we can do this training, but you've got to show us that there's a benefit.
Right. If we say that we're going to implement these management practices for X species to recover or to increase, so, you know, if we are writing a quail plan, we need to be able to show that we created more quail.
Or even or on whatever. The opposite side, an invasive. We're going to remove it and we're going to show what this does.
And then something awesome grew up in its place.
Right.
We need to be able to see that through.
Right. So there's, especially I'm from the federal side with money now, there's more and more requirements every year. They're getting more detailed on the information that they want to show that we're spending taxpayer dollars for something that's actually doing a benefit to the public.
Yep. And the philanthropists, the same thing. They want to see
exactly
the results and be able to, that's why it's so awesome with the technology we have and the people willing to collaborate with us, volunteers, citizen science, being able to see those guild shifts or see species respond to whatever habitat management action we've put on the ground, or being able to capture that increase in water quality, you know, or improved water quality, soil quality, all those things.
Right.
Where, and it doesn't matter who's in charge. They want to know that information.
Right. You know, and politicians that are sending this money or the philanthropists that is, you know, paying for whatever this little project is, a lot of them don't understand the science side of things, but they understand the numbers. And that's where the monitoring a lot of times comes in. It's like, you can't just give them an abstract idea necessarily and let that be enough. They want to see the numbers. They want to see the pretty graphs or the pictures or sort of things. And so it's gotten to where we spend a whole lot of our time doing monitoring.
Right.
And the reporting that goes along with the monitoring. I know a lot of the staff complain sometimes because it's like, oh my gosh, this has become half of my job. And sometimes the year, it may be 100% of your job getting out there and doing the monitoring instead of doing the technical assistance or being on the ground doing the management work.
I mean, most of us did get into this to be more connected to the critters. So I never understand why people don't want to.
It's more the plant monitoring that most of them don't like.
So that, that's another.
In 100 degree weather.
That's another hour later on for me to get on a soapbox about. But I say easily now that most of my days is sitting behind a computer or a steering wheel. But
yeah,
it's all necessary and it is accountability, but it is, again, it's also making sure that what we're recommending is working.
Right.
And as things change, we're going to need to change.
Go back to adaptive.
That's right. Yep.
Because things, nothing stays the same. Nature's constantly changing.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're not adaptive to it, if you'll go back and look at plans for different species written, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, we did this, and that was the plan for the next 50 years, is you did this.
Yeah.
But that was written for the way the population and the habitat and the whole environment around it was at that point in time. And it still is. When we write a plan, we tell landowners, this is written for what it is now, what your goals are now.
Mm-hmm.
In 3 years, that could be totally different.
Right.
Hopefully the habitat's going to be different because you've done management.
Mm-hmm. And time goes very quickly.
It does.
And that is what I see a lot with our landowners that we're working on in some of these big projects with industrial places, let's say. So they'll call us out. Some of them you and I have worked on 10 years ago will call us now 10 years later and say, hey, this hasn't been working.
Yeah.
And you ask them, what have you been doing? Have you followed the plan? Well, no.
Part of it. We need it for a year.
And it's like, well, I'm ready to start this plan. And sometimes they have. And they've been working on that plan for a couple of years and nothing's happening. And it's because that plan was written for 10 years ago.
Right.
You've let it go now for 10 years. You're in a whole different scenario. Right. So
things have grown up or
relationships with biologists or foresters or extension. Like, it needs to be frequent.
Yeah. And I tell any landowner that I've worked with, and I tell, you know, it's something we remind everybody, is about every 2 to 3 years, you want to touch base with your biologist again and review that plan.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've hopefully done some of the work. And so now things have changed. The weather may have changed. Your resources may have changed. Maybe economically, you're not where you were back then, whether it's more or less. You could have had, you know, a huge event come through, like the hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
So you reset everything, and we've got to start over. A lot of it's going to be very similar, but the timing or the more fine scale approach to some of this is going to be different. Maybe you had, when we started this plan, you had invasives taking over half the property, and now you've got those invasives under control. Now what do you do?
Right.
And that's why you go back in, because most of us are not going to write that plan for what if, because we don't know what's going to come in behind it.
Yeah. Your burning timing could completely change.
Now we need to adjust this, because, well, we did burning at this time of the year, like you said, for the last 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. and now it's just all grasses. Well, we need to adjust that timing now. Let's get a little more diversity and some forbs in here, mm-hmm. or vice versa.
Or now your invasives are under control, we can thin, or you know, some other big activity could actually take place.
Right. And, you know, talking about thinning, you know, the markets have changed. Look at how many mills have been shutting down recently. So that's going to affect how a lot of people are going to manage their forest. And maybe we need to look at some different management options. So definitely keep up with that. And that's where, again, when the monitoring comes into play, it's very critical, not just on an agency or, you know, an NGO level, looking at it from a broad population, but on your property, so that you can look at what those species are doing over time and adjust your management. All right. So I'm feeling the 5 a.m. early morning rise this morning now, starting to catch up with me and the lack of food.
Am I starting to space out?
my stomach, I think, speaks to start growling. I figure people start going to hear it here in a moment. So we'll kind of wrap things up. And
well, all that talk about biscuits this morning and then the place being closed.
I was so upset.
It was kind of a letdown. I'm surprised you've made it this long.
I know. Especially when I was all ready for a biscuit.
Yeah.
Because one of my favorite places. That's like my treat to myself after hunting or monitoring. Dang.
Denied.
I know. But hopefully that helps people understand a little bit more about why we ask for some of the data that we ask for, mm-hmm. encourage them to get engaged, to submit that information.
Get engaged. Be patient.
Yes.
Like, we try our hardest to get information back to contributors, but sometimes it takes a long time.
That's a good point.
Could take a year or so sometimes to get data back, because these...
Lots of data coming in.
Lots of data. These ARUs are fantastic, but it produces a ton of data that we have to plug through a computer, which sounds simple, but it's not. And then we have to truth it to make sure things are correct.
Right.
Same thing with like getting wings in or whatever we're asking for. We need to process it, and it needs to go to a lab sometimes.
There's always some other request coming from someone that you got to take care of in the meantime that squirrels you off somewhere else.
Be patient. But with that said, don't be afraid to ask
and
check in. But
we've been pretty good. And I'm noticed.
Most are pretty good.
About getting the information. And when you do get the information, it's usually great information. So be engaged. Understand why, if you see some poor technician or biologist standing on the side of the road with a clipboard, what they're doing out at 6 o'clock in the morning. Or what the crazy boxes that are tied to trees are in the woods.
Don't be afraid to ask.
Yeah.
Get involved. Ask how you can set up something on your own property.
Right.
Because we don't need to be involved. We can show you how to do it.
Right.
And support you along the way. And I love including that data into things.
We've set up a lot of landowners with their own monitoring programs. So do that. Ask your biologist, your forester, whoever it may be, and get them to help you get set up and get a program for watching some of these species.
Yep. Cameras. We didn't talk about cameras, but that's always a good option too.
That's a big one. Yeah. That ties into some of the deer or whatever. Lots of other species you can use cameras for. So.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of options, things that you can get engaged with. It doesn't have to be highly specialized, but would definitely help you. All right. Anything else?
No, I think that's another hour for another day.
Yeah. Well, for that, we'll wrap it up, and appreciate it. Thanks.